Session number 31050, reel 4.
When was it you fell ill?
I fell ill round about in November, December of 44. And the operation was still in full swing then. I had an attack of nephritis, which was a kidney inflammation of the kidney. And I don't wonder when I think of the bowels and the the goings on that we had there. But I was in St Thomas's Hospital, and then I was evacuated by St Thomas's Hospital because the V2s or something were going on at that point. And you could hear them in St Thomas's. Although we were in the basement, you could hear explosion. And I went out to, eventually went out to Taunton on January the 1st, 1945.
That was as the secretary to the
secretary.
What was your reaction to the end of the war in Europe? What do you remember of
V-Day? I said I would never grumble again as long as I lived. The one of the most beautiful sights was in St Mary's Gardens. It's a triangular garden there. And when we were allowed to have the lights on, and everybody opened their curtains and all the lights were on, that was a magic sight. But that was before the end, quite the end of the war, when they knew it was coming to an end. That was a magic sight. I was home at that time. And then I came up to London. I was at Taunton, and I stood by a garden gate and looked at the country and thought what a wonderful day it was for the country. And I went home that night, and I went out the next day when they had all the celebrations, and I took the young Henry with me, who was about, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 might have been then. No, he's 9 years young, he must have been about 12. Henry by then was a chorister at Southwark Cathedral. He did quite a lot of important things, did Henry. But he's got Parkinson's now. It seems so unfair that he's so much younger than me, and he's no longer mobile. He flew to all the places where we had schools abroad as an inspector. He did courses all over, and he was particularly asked for in Bulgaria when it was under the Iron Curtain. He did about 4 trips there and spoke on the television, even when, you know, the Iron Curtain was in place. He said when he said he didn't agree with Mrs. Thatcher, there was a gasp from the audience, because he never did agree with Mrs. Thatcher. Well, she more or less handbagged him by telling him what secondary school should do, and he was very indignant about that.
How did you find the post-war atmosphere in Britain?
Well, I think everybody worked very well, and I mean, I had kids in East London who had been evacuated, had perhaps had half a day's schooling for most of their lives, you know, had 7-year-olds, and there were girls who said, oh, when the warning went, we ducked under the desks, and, you know, because I wasn't teaching during the actual war, but I was trained emergency, you see. So I only did a year's training, and then I had to do some evening classes for so long afterwards, and I did history of art, and that's how it was I came to teach that at the county high school. And I think I liked post-war Britain, really. I don't like it today so much. I feel everybody has got very careless about everybody else, unless it's just a square, which is now full of people like bought flats by big expensive companies that have their some of their people working in England and rent well, they live here but they're not resident, if you know what I mean. There are a lot of French and a lot of Americans in this square, in these sort of flats. It's why the prices of them are so ridiculous. The house along there that they converted, the whole house being sold for £7 million or £7,000 a week rent. Don't you like that? It's quite amusing, I mean. And it's only one of these houses. I mean, it's just up the street along there. And that's not such a good bit as this, because we've got a better garden just here. The garden is very nice, by the way. I mean, I'm lucky to have this flat. I'm just lucky. But I do find, you know, they come along the pavement with their prams and babies and children, and nobody... That pavement out there is about 3.5 metres wide, and yet they never move aside for you to pass. You have to go out, step in the curb. I think I've paid in my 50 years in this square, I've paid for these paving stones, and I'm not going to walk in the road. I know that people with children and babies should all be given, but it's no consideration. And as for the rubbish business, it just drives me mad. It's partly the council's fault. They've changed the arrangements for rubbish. This year, they started changing it on January the 1st, and I looked at it and I thought, that's a mistake, because January the 1st is a Tuesday. And they said, we will start on January the 1st. Your cleaning of rubbish will be Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. So I thought, well, we'll take it that we're going to be Wednesday. So, of course, everybody else thought it was still Tuesday, which was the previous, was Tuesdays and Fridays. So by then we had people doing Mondays and Tuesdays and Fridays. And then they went to Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, and now they've gone to Mondays, Wednesdays and Saturdays. So there's not a day in the week when there's not rubbish left out there, and it's on all the lampposts as to when it's to be collected. And for 6 months now, well, 5 months, nobody has had their rubbish out at the right time. So I despair of people today. They kind of don't do what they're supposed to do. And you ring up somebody. Now you do what you say you'll do. You say, I'll ring you up and tell you, or say before I'm coming. They say, you know, we'll call you and we'll send a man round at such, and they never come. And you know, I find everybody today is so lax about everything. Is that the word? I don't know whether you find it. I feel if I'm doing something, I'm doing it, you know. I know I had to cancel you, but I had to cancel a globe as well, which was awful, because I've never cancelled a globe in 10 years. And I missed all my 8 history plays, £160 worth, at the Roundhouse, and a trip to Chichester to see the cherry orchard. I missed a lot. Well, at 86 you can't do everything, can you?
Considering things like the continuation of rationing and so on, did you find any sort of sense of disillusionment in post-war Britain?
Well, I thought Attlee tried to do what he could, but it's a bit like Archbishops of Canterbury and Popes. You're not allowed to do what you want to do. I just think it's like that. There are too many other things in the way all the time. We had somebody who worked in Canterbury Cathedral. She said, I said, how's this new Archbishop going to... Oh, they'll soon get him in hand, she said. The Dean runs the cathedral, not the Archbishop. So you sort of think, well, these high posts, it's all the same. Somebody hedges you round and says, but you can't do that. I think Attlee was a very good, hard-working Prime Minister, but and did some very good things. Now Bevan did the health service. I mean, it was a very active period. Of course, they did away with the scholarships, the county scholarships. They went into the 11 plus, and then they started messing about with the A levels and the O levels. Education has never been, ever since I was in it as a child, has never stayed the same. As I left my primary school to go to the grammar school, the school that I was at was called the Big Girls, and it went up to 14. That stopped. And all the 14s, 13s, 12s had to go to a secondary school. But that's how it was then. I worked in classes with children of 14, you see, just coming up to 14, when I was 10, because I was in the top class at 10. And then that was stopped, and all primary schools had to stop at 11. And since then, everything's just gone on changing. Education never, never stops. Different exams, different things.
Did you go through any form of official demobilisation or anything like that?
No. I think I applied for an emergency training course, and I went for an interview, which I remember nothing about, excepting they commented on my name being Pluckrose. My family plucked a white rose for the House of York, and the red rose was the House of Lancaster, and things like that. There wasn't really a great deal of what you might call interrogation about it. And I went into junior school work. It was a wonderful college. Now, that was a wonderful place, that emergency college. Everybody there was ready to... We were like... We couldn't wait to do something. We had been bottled up for the whole... Look, 17 I was when war was declared. We had no real adolescence at all. And we were then funneled into all this business with the bombing and the trying to work at the bank and never being late. And then we were called up, and then we did what we had to do, and we all did it as well as we could. And as Julie said... We did it to win the war, didn't we? And we did. And I've got a poem in Mavis Williams's book. You know, I think Mavis Williams' book is in your archive somewhere. She wrote a book, this forewoman, on this particular piece of history. I don't know where it is, somewhere about. I've had it this morning. And you know, in it you see that we are all there to win the war. And after the war, we let free like butterflies. They said that although that college, emergency college, went on for 4 years, the first year, although they weren't the brainiest people there, the most equipped people, they were mostly people who'd been in schools already and, you know, done that, things like that. They were the keenest and the most ready to do anything that they were asked to do, because they'd waited so long, 6 years, to do it. And we were like that, I think. And I was friendly up with my personal tutor at the college up until she died last year. I sent her a card every month, and... they were remarkable teachers, those people.
To what extent did you find that the war changed the social standing of women and attitudes towards?
I think it did that. I think it certainly did that to some degree. Whether all, you know, the Carlton Club or anything accepted it, I don't know. But in the back of Mavis Williams' book, there is an article that was in the Bodmin Times or somewhere. And it said, we were women doing a man's work. And I mean, you look at my size and you think about it, you think, well, they couldn't have done a real man's day's work. But they were pretty kind of hardy people. And probably because I was one of the smallest, although they were all, I mean, Julia was the same size as me, and she had to do all the sawing. And I don't say that we did used the axes. I thought axes, one or two did. Mavis Williams did, of course, and she was smaller than me. Yes, she did an occasional blow with an axe. And Pat, who I also do correspond with, she also did some chopping of trees, but not many of the girls did trees. They did mostly sawing or chopping on a porter saw or bill hooks. We had bill hooks and stacking the kilns and that sort of thing, those sort of jobs. And of course a lot of the people coming in from outside, the women, they did a lot of burning and clearing and getting it ready, really, for the Ministry of Supply to plant the new trees. In fact, while we were there, the first lot of woods were planted with larch, and it was a very, very beautiful sight. A deciduous, you know, larch trees, and they're so beautiful. All the year round, they were yellow and gold in the autumn, and then they were crystal and sort of in the winter with the drops of ice on, and the spider's webs and things in the spring, and then they were the most beautiful green. I'd just been to Kew Gardens, and they've got a whole area of larch there that have just coming out. They look so beautiful. Did the treetop walk in honour of the trees that I so mutilated in the past. I'm also a life member of the Woodland Trust for the same reason, preserve the trees in the country. But that was all replanted, and the first time I went back, those trees were so immense I couldn't believe it. But now that has gone, that's been a forested crop, and that's gone, and now it's reverting much more to its old ways of hardwood, much nicer. But I do think after the war, for a certain number of years, we all tried very hard to make it a land fit for heroes, but alas, I can't say I think it's happened. I think it's become too money-oriented. And children, when they're asked what they want to be, say they want to be famous. Now, isn't that awful? They don't want to be anything useful.
How do you balance that situation with perhaps the reduction in the polarisation, the sort of social polarisation that perhaps you experienced a bit more before the war?
Well, I think that before the war, there was a chance, like my sister and brother and myself, to come out of what was a really very difficult trap of money with the scholarships. Well, then of course it went into the 11 pluses, and people were still able to go to get good education if they needed it. But then, you see, all the grammar schools in London are closed, excepting, I think, there's places like Henrietta Barnett, which are on special footings and so on. The ones that come above us, Woodford, on the list. I know them all because, you know, you get these. I mean, Woodford and Redbridge is a poor borough, but only places like Barnet are better. than Redbridge. Redbridge does very well. It's got the one grammar school. Well, the two grammar schools, because they've got the Ilford boys and the Woodford girls. And they're both a four-stream entry, and they're both entered by nothing to do with the school, just an exam that you can go in for if you want to. And, of course, they do very well there. I mean, that's where your doctors and your... And many... I met one of my old first forms in Snakes Lane, going up to Woodford to do some scenery last year. A small girl, no bigger than me, and she said, do you know, she said, turning towards the direction of the school, she said, I would never be a doctor if it hadn't been for Woodford. You see? And she probably wouldn't have been. I mean, that does break the social barrier, getting to somewhere where you get. You may not have any aspirations to be a doctor when you're just living in some back street. I mean, I never thought of being anything, excepting I wanted to do art. That was all I knew, and I could probably have been a doctor for that matter, because science was my best subject, but it never crossed my mind to be that. But I've seen a lot of girls through in my 22 years at Woodford from poor families who've done well, and you know, you feel that they have crossed the barrier, but a lot of other people that could have crossed the barrier, it's education that does it all the time, in my view. And a lot of the grammar schools do still exist in the country. I know my brother's against grammar schools, of course, because he's in favour of equality, but you see, you can't give equality to all children in all primary schools, because if you get a whole lot like we had at Bow, before they cleared all those Bow Streets out, we had children from the back of Tower Hamlets Cemetery. There were 6 or 8 children, sometimes 12, and sometimes only one of them could learn to read easily. You know, the others just, you taught them something. Don't tell me that you... I mean, people argue this with you, that everybody can be taught to read, but some people, it takes them 15 years to learn to read. And they're never going to want to really read. One boy said he wanted to be a lorry driver. He couldn't put two words together. I said, you'll never be able to follow the roads if you can't read the signs on the roads. You've got to read to be a lorry driver. I should think that was a form of escape, of driving out of... Oh, there was some very, very sad... I went there, you see. I asked to go to East London because I thought I was giving back something that I had had in education. But I found it very hard. I mean, a lot of the parents weren't cooperative in the way of education. And a lot of them just simply didn't have... I mean, we had a family of archers that went on and on and on. And... you know, you've got Siddy Archer, you've got Tommy Archer, you've got one after another. Pat Archer was the one who could read. You see, but you'd have thought she might teach the others, but no, you could hear them all playtime, all dinner hours. You devote your whole life to the reading, but you still have, at the end of it, when they were doing their 11 plus, they could only write their name on the paper. And that's terrible, isn't it?
Do you think it's possible?
Before the 60s, that would be. I left in the 60s.
Do you think it's possible to have an education system that can cater for everyone?
Well, I wouldn't mind schools that, say, senior schools that specialise. Like, you could have a really good modern language school, or like Woodford, a good grammar school, or a good science school with lots of labs where children went who could do that sort and get on well with it. But you've got to have some schools where the basics of everything are really taught, basically, like I was taught at my little church school. This I've been putting up with for days. Both sides. They do nothing but redo these two. I think it's because they're penthouses. They crack everywhere. And they keep on repairing them.
You, I think, touched on this a little bit before, but what was your attitude towards the Germans during the war?
Well, in a way, I felt sorry for them. I'd got this correspondent over there that I'd had all through my German lessons at school. And after the war, I paid for her to come over and spend a month over here. It was 1948 she came. I was just married, 49. I didn't get on awfully well with her. Unlike me, after the war, who was never going to grumble, she grumbled all the time. She even grumbled going back. I went to no end of trouble to try to get her a berth. She came with me to Thomas Cook's, and I tried to get the berth, and I only had a little money in the bank. I spent it on her, just to show that there was some, you know, she wasn't to blame for the war. And the first card she sent me after she got back was not to thank me for anything, but to grumble that she'd had to sit up all night, which I have done many a time going places. But I was very disillusioned about that. But we had some very nice German girls come to Greycoat when I was there, of the same group, from the same class, that stayed with the girls, the nice middle class girls we had there, and they were very nice. And I liked them, I liked those German girls. It just happened that my correspondent wasn't somebody who got on with me somehow, I don't know. I did my best for them. I've only been to Germany once in my art travels, to Cologne and cathedral or two.
And what now is your attitude towards the war as a whole and its effect on your life?
Well, I think we exhausted ourselves on it. I think if it weren't for America and the Marshall Plan, we'd have really done even worse. But it took us so long to get over it. I don't know how much of you remember of it, but it seems to have been a long drag before we got into this climate of wealth that we're in now. We're about to fall out of. I can't say that. I mean, I've enjoyed all my trips to the continent, and I never went to Canada. Austin went back two or three times to Canada, but it was always very expensive. Of course, I remained poor all through Austin's life, really. I was better off when I retired. I retired in 82 and he died in 92. But we were fairly, because he wasn't insured, he didn't get any pension or anything until he was 80, when I think he got something like £27 a week. And he sold very little. I had to keep a roof over our heads. We had no place to live, you see. We lived in single rooms for 9 years, and we were fortunate to have a single unfurnished room along the street here. And that's how we met the Miss Potts, who were the three surviving daughters of the man who built this row of houses and this house. So that's how, when they wanted somebody to help them pay their rates, because they were the three surviving children and everything had gone up and they couldn't afford anything, they offered us this flat. That's how we got it. And we paid rent. until Austin died, and it so happened at the time that the